This is a very famous picture. This is from April of 1975. The helicopter is atop the embassy, the American embassy in Saigon. And this is the last helicopter flight for evacuating people from Saigon before Saigon fell. During the month prior to this, they had started a slow evacuation. They didn't really want to get everyone all concerned about things impending with an impending fall and so forth. But the idea that they had was that there would be a lot of planes that would fly in and fly out. But on April 29th, the day before this, the airport was attacked. And as a result of the rocket attack that was launched against the airport, and the fact that one South Vietnamese fighter pilot decided to defect and to show his intention to defect, he bombed the only runway that was still operational. So everyone had to go out by helicopter. And as you can imagine, that makes it so that it's difficult to get very many people out. And yet during that last month, they evacuated about 110,000 people, largely by planes, but then at the very end, strictly by helicopter. They would fly out to American aircraft carriers, and space was at such a premium so that they could allow more helicopters to come aboard that after a helicopter landed, they would push it off into the ocean to make more space so that they could load up more people and there could be more helicopters to land. Now, with that as the backdrop, what do you think about this picture? We see people here carrying handbags. Now, can you imagine sitting next to someone with a big handbag? Go back two pictures. If there weren't any handbags, how many more people could they have gotten onto those planes, those helicopters? How many more people could have been pulled out because of the bloodbath that occurred? So, now here you have people who have been, rescued. Can you imagine the arguments that took place as they were on the helicopter as to, why did you bring that? My sister couldn't get on this helicopter because of your handbag. Now, what I want to point out is, when they were trying to get into the helicopter, the big thing is, let's get in there. But you know how people are. Once they get in, are they going to have a nice, pleasant flight over to the aircraft carrier? Or can you imagine all of the tensions boiling over and them arguing and bickering and fighting the whole way? And suddenly, the rescue that has just happened has gone into the background, has it not? That's kind of how human nature works. As we look at Genesis chapter 43, we are going to see an illustration of human nature not working the way it normally works. Because we're going to see some people who have been shaped by the Lord over a period of time. So we're having this as a contrast. Genesis chapter 43. Now, last time we spoke about Genesis chapter 42, and there we saw that near the start of a 7-year famine, that Jacob said to his sons, "Why are you looking at one another? You need to go to Egypt to buy some food." But he would not allow his youngest son, Benjamin, to go. After all, he knew that when he had sent all the sons out, and then Joseph came to check on them, Joseph didn't come back. So he doesn't want to take the risk of losing Benjamin, who is the other son of Rachel, his favorite wife. Now, why is it that they needed to go there to get this grain? Why did they need to go all the way to Egypt? Well, glad you asked. Remember how we had looked at Pharaoh having dreams, and Joseph, because God gave him the wisdom to interpret the dreams, was able to come up with a plan. There were going to be 7 years of plenty, and at the end of the 7 years of plenty, there would be 7 years of famine. But Egypt, which is at the north end of Africa, depends on the 4,000-mile-long Nile River. As a result of that river being the longest river in the world, Egypt normally can count on the Nile River. Because it might not be raining in one place, but it's raining somewhere else. But when God brought this famine, the famine was so extensive that it affected Egypt. It made it so that during the 7 years of famine, not even Egypt had good crops. But then you look at a place like Israel, where the longest river is not very long at all. Clearly, they had problems. So early in the famine, Jacob, in chapter 42, said there's a problem. He sent his sons there, and when they went down to Egypt, they were able to buy grain. They didn't know it, but they were talking with Joseph, and they were able to buy grain as Joseph spoke through an interpreter. And in the process, Joseph asked a number of questions and determined that, yes, indeed, they had another son, another brother, Benjamin, and their father was still alive. And so then he told them that they needed to bring that younger son. They needed to bring Benjamin, and if he didn't see Benjamin, he would never sell them any more grain. Well, in Genesis chapter 43... notice how they have run out of grain. Verses 1 through 15, Jacob told his sons to buy grain in Egypt, but only reluctantly sent Benjamin with the brothers, despite what the Egyptian had said. The Egyptian, that is Joseph, had said that Benjamin needed to be sent, and if he were not sent, he would not sell them any grain. Verses 1 and 2. Upon running out of grain, Jacob told his sons to buy grain in Egypt. Now the famine was severe in the land, and it came to pass, when they had eaten up the grain which they had brought from Egypt, that their father said to them, "Go back, buy us a little food." He says, "No big deal. Time to go to the grocery store and, you know, just pick up a little more. Maybe this time bring a yank tank, pulling a trailer, and maybe you can haul a little more." And so they've run out of their food. And he says, "Okay, no problem. Just go down there, go buy some more." In verse 3, Judah is going to speak, and the other brothers are going to chime in. So in verses 3 through 5, the brothers, led by Judah, reminded Jacob that the Egyptian would not see them. That is, he wouldn't see them in order to give them grain unless they brought Benjamin with them. But Judah spoke to him, saying, "The man solemnly warned us, saying, 'You shall not see my face unless your brother is with you. If you send our brother with us, we will go down and buy you food. But if you will not send him, we will not go down, For the man said to us, "You shall not see my face unless your brother is with you." Now, as we consider this passage, notice who is taking leadership. It is not Reuben. Reuben's the firstborn. Remember how Reuben had tried to prevent the brothers from doing harm to Joseph? But how persuasive was he? He was not. And when we saw Simeon and Levi, were they fair and honest in their dealings with the Canaanites? Remember what they had said. Oh, yes, after Dinah had been raped, that they would be quite happy to intermarry, but it's just necessary for the Canaanites to be circumcised first. And while they were healing up from their surgery, they attacked the town and killed all the males in the town. Who is it that exercises leadership in this family? It's not Jacob. It's not Reuben. It's not Simeon and Levi. It is Judah. And who listens to Judah? The other brothers listen to Judah. The father listens to Judah. And Joseph deals with him. Notice that Judah has already, at the end of chapter 42, made sure to make it clear that Benjamin needed to go with them if they were going to buy grain. He didn't persuade his father earlier, but now he makes the case, and ultimately Jacob is going to be persuaded. When we see Judah, we see someone who is able to take leadership, and he is able to stand up for what is true. I think that's a major reason, as we look in Genesis chapter 49, that the leadership of the nation was placed on the shoulders of Judah. And Judah is the line out of which Jesus Christ came. Let's take a look over at Genesis chapter 49. Here we have blessings on each of the sons of Jacob. Let's start at verse 8. Judah, which means praised, are he whom your brothers shall praise. Your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's children shall bow down before you. Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, you have gone up. He bows down, he lies down as a lion, and as a lion, who shall rouse him? The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet, until Shiloh comes, and to him shall be the obedience of the people. Now the statement of a lawgiver from beneath his feet is a reference to through procreation. There's always going to be a lawgiver, and that's going to happen until Shiloh comes. But the word Shiloh is not a name. Shiloh is a phrase. She is whom? To whom? Le means, is the word for two. And then the O ending at the end means to him. The one to whom it belongs. The one to whom what belongs? The scepter. The rulership. And notice, he rules over even his brothers. Your father's children, verse 8, shall bow down before you. He is the one, he is the tribe out of which the leadership of Israel comes. And Jesus is the one to whom the scepter belongs. So in this passage, Jacob has pronounced him to be the ruler over all of the rest of the tribes. And that rulership is going to be maintained until and including Jesus Christ. So as we look at verses 3 and 5, we see Judah taking leadership, and he says, Dad, it's not going to do any good for us to go down there, because this man doesn't just want us to bring him bags of silver. He has said, I will not bargain with you unless you bring Benjamin. Dad, this is what has to happen. Well, that instantly made Jacob start whining. So in verse 6, Jacob whined that they shouldn't have mentioned Benjamin to the Egyptian. If you hadn't mentioned him, he wouldn't have asked about him. Little did Jacob know. Because he did not know that this Egyptian was really his son, that knew that indeed there was another son named Benjamin, and he was going to probe, and he was going to find out whether Benjamin was still alive, or whether his brothers had done him in, and how he was doing, and he wanted to see him. So in verse 6, Israel, that's the other name for Jacob, said, Why did you deal so wickedly with me as to tell the man whether you had still another brother? I think Jacob has a persecution complex. In verse 7, the brothers said that they had no idea that the Egyptian would require bringing Benjamin. We innocently mentioned this. We had not a clue. Verse 7. But they said, the man asked us pointedly about ourselves and our family, saying, is your father still alive? Have you another brother? And we told him according to these words. Could we possibly have known that he would say, bring your brother down? We had no idea what he was going to ask. We just answered a question. And then he said, bring him down. We weren't trying to do any harm to you. Judah steps in once again. In verses 8 through 10, Judah pledged himself as surety, as insurance for Benjamin's safe return. Then Judah said to Israel, his father, send the lad with me, and we will arise and go, that we may live and not die, both we and you, and also our little ones. I myself will be surety for him from the hand you shall require him. If I do not bring him back to you and set him before you, then let me bear the blame forever. For if we had not lingered, surely by now we would have returned this second time. Judah is exercising leadership. And he says, Dad, send him with me. I will be the personal guarantor that things go well, that he comes back. And Dad, we need to have him go. Notice what he says. That we may live and not die. And who is he defining as we? Is he defining we as Judah and Benjamin? Look very closely. That we may live and not die, both we and you and also our little ones. He's saying, the whole family is on the verge of starvation. And if we don't go and we don't buy food from the one person who has it, who has stipulated one condition under which we will receive food, we're all going to die. I will be surety, but Benjamin needs to come. It's the only hope that the whole family has for staying alive. In verse 9, I myself will be surety for him. And he says, let me bear the blame forever if I don't bring him back. This is different than what happened with Joseph, isn't it? Who owned up and told Dad what happened to Joseph? Nobody did. They killed a couple of kid goats, put the blood on the cloak, and sold him as a slave, or sold him to people who would take him down into Egypt and sell him as a slave. Nobody leveled with Dad, did they? None of them were willing to take the blame. Now Judah is older. And what does Judah do? He says, I will take personal responsibility, and if I fail, it's my fault. I'll carry the blame. And he carried the argument a little further in verse 10. If we had not lingered, if we hadn't waited until our food was just about out, notice how verse 2 said, and it came to pass when they had eaten up the grain which they had brought from Egypt. He said, I don't know how long this Egyptian is going to wait around. Yeah, he said, you bring back that other brother of yours, then I'll see you. But he might think that we didn't really care about him, and you know, maybe he doesn't really trust us. We've taken our time. We could already be back there with Benjamin if it hadn't been for the delays that have happened. Dad, you've got to make a decision now, because otherwise some of the people in our family are going to start to starve. Dad, you've waited until it's a crisis. You've waited until we've run out of food, and now we have to travel and there's not enough food. You can't delay any longer, Dad. Who's taking leadership? It's Judah. Judah is the only one who's rising to the challenge. Dad isn't, and the other brothers aren't. But Judah is rising to the occasion. I think we ought to make a pertinent point. Of the brothers who traveled to Egypt, who do you think is the most rewardable? Judah. And look at the reward that he has. It includes that out of his lineage comes the Messiah. And he's going to have a special rank and special privilege, because the leadership of the nation from this point forward is always out of his tribe. That's a pretty good size reward, isn't it? We look at life and sometimes we think, well, I'll let George do it. I'll let someone else do it. Just think, if Judah had said, I'll let one of my other brothers rise to the occasion. Judah stepped forward. This is faithfulness. He knew the right thing to do and he did it. And you look at the size of the reward that is set forth here, that is a significant reward. God wants faithful servants. And that is what we are seeing in Judah. In verses 11 through 14, Jacob agreed to send Benjamin, and he said to bring a gift and double payment. Verse 11, and their father Israel said to them, if it must be so, then do this. Take some of the best fruits of the land in your vessels and carry down a present for the men, a little balm, little honey, spices, and myrrh, pistachio nuts, and almonds. Take double money in your hand, and take back in your hand the money that was returned in the mouth of your sacks. Perhaps it was an oversight. Take your brother also, and arise, go back to the men. And may Almighty God give you mercy before the man, that he may release your other brother and Benjamin. If I am bereaved, I am bereaved. So he said, okay, you're right. There's no alternative. But let's handle this wisely. Let's do it in the best possible way. Let's bring this man the choicest of the things that we can bring to him. And so, don't go down there empty-handed. Yes, you're going to be coming back carrying a lot of grain, but as you go, let's carry things for him. And notice, in verse 12, they are to take double money plus the money that was returned. So it's actually triple money. We'll make sure that we pay for that which we had purchased and somehow the money came back. But you bring twice as much money as you're expecting to need in order to bring grain back. So it's actually triple money. And the big point here in verse 13, take your brother also and arise, go back to the men. Jacob has accepted the leadership of his son. And this becomes a significant reason as to why, when the blessing was given in chapter 49, that he could make the pronouncement upon Judah that he did. There's something interesting here. Something of great interest. Let's think back and let's remember Jacob. When Jacob left Laban, he started thinking, I'm going to face my brother, Esau, that one that wanted to kill me. And what did he do? He sent waves of people with all sorts of livestock saying, this is a gift for you, Esau, and somewhere back there is Jacob. As Esau passes, he runs into another man who has big flocks, and he says, these are all from Jacob, and somewhere behind is Jacob. And what did Jacob do? He put his two concubines and their kids out front. And then he put Leah and her kids out. And then he put Rachel. And then he had an escape route for himself in case all those didn't appease Esau. But this time around, Jacob knows that there's only one way that he's going to be delivered. Look at verse 14. And may God Almighty give you mercy before the men, that he may release your other brother and Benjamin. If I am bereaved, I am bereaved. He realizes that it's not the gifts, it's not the money, it's not even sending Benjamin. He realizes that God needs to work in this man's heart, just as he had obviously worked in Esau's heart. I think Jacob has learned a few lessons. But it was extremely hard for him to reach this point because it was difficult for him to send Benjamin. And we, as parents, can all identify with this. This was a terribly difficult step for him to take, but in the end, he accepted the leadership of his son, Judah. So in verse 15, the brothers brought Benjamin a gift and double payment. So the men took that present and Benjamin, and they took double money in their hand and arose and went down to Egypt, and they stood before Joseph. In verses 16 through 30, we have them arriving down in Egypt. By the way, something rather interesting. If you compare chapter 42 and 43, there are a lot of similarities. They both start with everyone hungry in Israel, with the father saying, "You got to go down to Egypt to get some food." They go down there, and then they come back. And you have the same sequence of events in both of these chapters. So now in verses 16 through 30, the brothers feared their meeting with the Egyptian, but were met with an inexplicable level of grace. The prayer that Jacob had issued has indeed been answered. In verses 16 through 18, Joseph saw Benjamin with his brothers, so he told his steward to prepare a feast. But the invitation caused the brothers to fear a trap. As you may remember, what was their reaction when they found money in the bags? God is doing us in. They knew what they had done to Joseph, did they not? Well, they're going to have the same type of a response here. So verses 16 through 18. When Joseph saw Benjamin with them, he said to the steward of his house, "Take these men to my home and slaughter an animal, and make ready, for these men will dine with me at noon." Then the man did as Joseph ordered, and the man brought the men into Joseph's house. Now the men were afraid because they were brought into Joseph's house, and they said, "It is because of the money which was returned in our sacks the first time that we are brought in, so that he may make a case against us and seize us to take us as slaves with our donkeys." Joseph has seen here in verse 16 that they have followed through on what he ordered. He said, "Bring Benjamin." And he sees that Benjamin is present with them. And so at that point, he says that he will have an audience with them, but he will do so in his home. And he tells his steward, the man in charge of his household, "Take them there and get ready for a big feast that we're going to eat." But then in verse 18, the response is one of great fear. Now, all of you are familiar with this fairy tale. Oops. About Santa Claus wanting to know if people are naughty or nice. And then he determines whether he's going to give gifts at Christmas. And lo and behold, all the little kids figure that they're good enough to get the gifts. When you think about that, that's not really a gift, is it? Because if you have to earn it, it's not a gift. Well, these brothers are saying, oh, we know we were naughty. Why would he be fixing up a meal? Is it because he wants to lavish it on us because we've been so good? Oh, there's that little problem of that money in the top of our sacks. We knew God was getting us. God was getting us because of what we did to Joseph. And there's no way that we can prove that we didn't steal that money. They're saying, we've been naughty little boys. And even though we didn't do anything bad to this Egyptian, little did they know they really did. He's out to get us. Although I think it is kind of interesting. Can you imagine how opulent a house Joseph lived in? He has a steward, doesn't he? And he didn't say, go down to Ralph's and buy some things for a meal. What did he say? Slaughter an animal. He's apparently got some land and he's got some animals. Joseph's a very wealthy man. And doesn't that make it rather humorous? Look at the end of verse 18. They think that he wants to make a case against them and seize us to take us as slaves with our donkeys. You know, these are Rolls-Royce donkeys, maybe Yank Tank version donkeys. I mean, you know, they're saying, oh, boy, not only does he want to make us slaves, but he wants to take our donkeys. Well, let's think back. Hadn't they been the ones responsible for Joseph becoming a slave? Isn't it interesting how the Lord has put on the other foot the same judgments that were imposed upon Joseph? They have experienced them. There he was saying, with brothers like these, who need enemies? And they're saying, I don't know that this dinner party was such a good idea. Maybe Dad was right. Maybe we should have just starved to death instead of coming down here to Egypt. Well, in verses 19 through 23, since Joseph will not be arriving until noon, they have an opportunity to talk to the steward. Now, what we had seen in chapter 42 was that Joseph had told the steward to actually put the money back in the sacks. The steward is the one who's really in charge of everything. So when they talk with a steward, they're talking with someone that they knew would have Joseph's ear, and they're hoping that he'll put in a good word for them that, no, they really aren't thieves, because they're saying, we've only got one shot here to make a case to spare our lives. So, in verses 19 through 23, the brothers told the steward that inexplicably their payment for the grain had been returned to them. But the steward attributed the returned treasure to their God. Verses 19 through 23. When they drew near to the steward of Joseph's house, they talked with him at the door of the house and said, O sir, we indeed came down the first time to buy food. But it happened when we came to the encampment that we opened our sacks, and there each man's money was in the mouth of his sack, our money in full weight, so that we have brought it back in our hand. We have it right here. Here's all the money. You can count it. It's all here. And we have brought down other money in our hands to buy food. We do not know who put the money in our sacks. It certainly wasn't us. We didn't steal it. But he said, peace be with you. Do not be afraid. Your God and the God of your father has given you treasure in your sacks. I had your money. Then he brought Simeon out to them. So they've got this big speech rehearsed. They're all ready to say, we're not thieves. We're not spies like he accused us of being either. And see, we brought Benjamin. We're trying to follow all the rules, but somehow our money ended up being back in there. But, you know, we've got plenty of money to buy this grain, and we have the money that somehow we found in our sacks. And, everything is really going horribly wrong, but we're honest men. They're a little different than they once were, aren't they? Remember how they would try to weasel around and trick people? They're trying to be straightforward and honest. How many conversations do you think that they had with Judah? We may well be seeing the imprint of Judah on the rest of the brothers here. They're not trying tricks. They're being straightforward and honest. I find verse 23 to be fascinating. The steward said, "Peace be with you. Do not be afraid. Your God and the God of your father has given you treasure in your sacks." Notice that he attributed it to their God. What did we see in chapter 42 when Joseph spoke with him? Did not Joseph tell them that he also feared God? They thought he was an Egyptian, but somehow they're wondering, how was it that he found out about our God? And I'm sure that he said enough. They knew that he was speaking of their God. Same thing is happening here. Where do you think the steward found out about this God? Two guesses. You ought to get it on the first one. Joseph. Joseph's the one who's told his steward about this God. And clearly, Joseph has told the steward, watch these fellows here and see what they say. See if they try to return the money that I had you put back into their sacks. Because Joseph was the one that had told him to do that. And lo and behold, he says, this has come from your God and the God of your father. He's the one that's given you treasure in your sacks. Now he says, I had your money. Now this is sort of like a few years ago, we had someone famous say, it depends on what is means. Okay, well here it depends on what had means. They've got the impression he had it and he still has it. That is, he didn't lose it. But he says, I had it. He didn't say, I gave it back to you. He just tells the first part of the story. But what do you think really made them calm down? The last part of the verse. At the end of the verse, then he brought Simeon out to them. Now they're saying, wait a moment. This isn't all making sense. They certainly are rejoicing at this point. Now in verses 24 to 25, while they awaited Joseph's arrival at home for the feast, they prepared his gift. You remember Joseph had told his steward to prepare the meal and that he would be joining them at noon in order to eat it. So in verse 24, so the men brought the men into Joseph's house and gave them water, and they washed their feet and gave their donkeys feed. Then they made the present ready for Joseph's coming at noon, for they heard that he would eat bread there. They are receiving grace and hospitality from the steward. And then they have plenty of time to prepare the gifts that they're able to give it to Joseph when he comes there for the meal. And so they're following through on the instructions that were given to them by Jacob. Again, they're seeking to do things in an orderly and appropriate fashion. Then in verses 26 through 28, they gave the gift, bowed, and answered Joseph's questions about Jacob. When Joseph came home, they brought him the present which was in their hand into the house and bowed down before him to the earth. Then he asked them about their well-being and said, "Is your father well, the old man of whom you spoke? Is he still alive?" And they answered, "Your servant, our father, is in good health. He is still alive." And they bowed their heads down and prostrated themselves. Remember how it was one of Joseph's dreams that they would all bow down before him, and lo and behold, that's being fulfilled again. They've given the gift, and they have indicated to him by the bowing respect. And he is asked questions, and they're probably once again wondering, why does he keep pressing us about our family? Last time we said a few things, it made things get real complicated, and you can imagine that they're a little nervous about what they're going to say this time. But he keeps pressing them with questions. Then in verses 29 and 30, Joseph pronounced blessing on Benjamin, and then he excused himself to weep. Then he lifted his eyes and saw his brother Benjamin, his mother's son. You remember there were four wives through whom Jacob had children. And said, "Is this your younger brother of whom you spoke to me?" And he said, "God be gracious to you, my son." Now his heart yearned for his brother. So Joseph made haste and sought somewhere to weep. And he went into his chamber, his bedroom, and wept there. So he's able to look at Benjamin closely, and he pronounces a blessing. Is this a generic blessing? Is it a politically correct blessing? No, it isn't. God be gracious to you. My, but wouldn't it be wonderful if we had politicians like that today? Need I say more? Now his heart yearned for his brother, so Joseph made haste and sought somewhere to weep. Joseph would love to reveal himself to his brothers at this point. But he is still needing to find out whether they are ready for the things that God has put before them. Right now he wants to find out the type of jealousy that had provoked them to sell him into slavery and almost provoked them to kill him. Did they have that type of a hatred and jealousy for Benjamin? He wanted to find that out. Well, in verses 31 through 34, things are going to come to a head fairly quickly. At the feast, they were seated in birth order, and Benjamin received extravagant blessings from Joseph. Verses 31 and 32. Joseph, acting as an Egyptian, sat separately from him as he ordered the feast to be served. 31 and 32. Then he washed his face and came out, and he restrained himself and said, "Serve the bread." So they set him a place by himself, and them by themselves, and the Egyptians who ate with him by themselves, because the Egyptians could not eat food with the Hebrews, for that is an abomination to the Egyptians. After he's been weeping, he makes sure to show himself in a very business-like, non-emotional sort of way, and he says, okay, it's time for the meal to be served. So he tells those that are involved in that to serve. And you notice, he sits by himself. There are other Egyptians present. They sit by themselves, and these brothers all sit by themselves because there could not be intermingling. That's going to turn out to be important. And we'll see more indications of that further in Genesis. Because one of the problems that the sons of Jacob had was they were too friendly with the Canaanites. And God rescued them from their friendliness with the Canaanites by putting them in Egypt, where they were in a country that was decidedly unfriendly towards Hebrews. After all, look at what happened in a matter of generations. They were made into slaves. But it did keep them from picking up a lot of the false religion of the Egyptians. But in this passage, Joseph is acting like an Egyptian, so, okay, we can have a nice meal here, but that doesn't mean that I'm going to get all chummy-chummy with you guys. And so he sits one place, other Egyptians sit another place, and the brothers are sitting by themselves, and there's not much interaction going on here. Well, then in verse 33, the brothers start looking and they say, something very interesting has happened. The brothers were amazed that they were seated in birth order. Verse 33. And they sat before him, the firstborn according to his birthright and the youngest according to his youth, and the men looked in astonishment at one another. If you remember, all the sons were born in a 7-year period of time through 4 mothers. That is, all of them except Benjamin were born within a 7-year span. So how are you going to know who for sure is the 3rd oldest? The 2nd oldest? The 4th? Some of them are going to be real close to one another. And as a result of that, since they had different mothers, when Joseph has asked questions, he didn't ask them, are you the oldest? Are you 2nd? Are you 3rd? He asked all sorts of questions about the family, but he didn't ask them their birth order, did he? Because they are amazed. This is Joseph's 2nd time with them. Joseph, the one who interprets dreams and the one who has been given dreams by God, seems to have already known that which he was going to do in checking his brothers out. So there they are sitting and they're saying, the money was returned to us. That was God dealing. Talk to a man and he says, I worship God, even though he's an Egyptian. Then we talk to the steward and we're trying to give back the money. And he says, well, I had the money. Your God and the God of your father is the one who put treasure in your sacks. And now he knows the order in which each of us was born. Do you think they're starting to see that maybe God is involved in this? I suspect so. Well, in verse 34, Joseph gave of his food to the brothers, but served Benjamin with helpings 5 times as large as for the others. Then he took servings to them from before him. The food starts out at his table. And Joseph is there. Remember, Joseph is by himself and the other Egyptians are by themselves and then the brothers. It looks like the serving table is the one at which Joseph's sitting. So therefore, they get the picture. All this blessing has come from Joseph. And according to what Joseph has said and the steward, that blessing has ultimately come from God, hasn't it? And so he's blessing all of them, but then there's Benjamin, and he's not the firstborn. He's not the one who has normally the extra rights. And what does he get? Five times as much food. And they drank and were merry with him. Did they get provoked into jealousy? Saying, well, we got rid of that one brother that our father was pouring all kinds of extra blessings on him, and he was discriminating against us. And wow, history's repeating itself. Look at how Benjamin is being treated like better than any of us. That last statement, they drank and were merry with him. They weren't grumbling, saying, why is Benjamin being blessed? They realize that they were dead men. Because after all, they walked in there and they thought, he's going to accuse us. He's brought us to his house to accuse us. Remember how they said, when they found the money in the sacks, God is going to get us because of what we did to Joseph. God is working in them. And these brothers who had such an intense jealousy of Joseph have gone out of their way to protect Benjamin. Remember how Reuben said, I'll even let you kill my two sons. We can appreciate that Reuben wanted to do the right thing, but it wasn't exactly the wisest way of going about it. Judah says, I will be surety for him. I will make sure that he comes back, and if he doesn't, I will bear the blame. These brothers are looking out for Benjamin. They're not trying to do him in. And even when blessing is lavished upon him, they are enjoying this time of fellowship. I have to tell you a humorous story. Diane and I went to a restaurant with some friends that we'd never been to a restaurant with them before. And so what happened was they ordered family style, and so there was a lot of food in the center of the table. And that's, so there we were. We ate food. That, and you know, I thought, well, I'll be polite, and I'll just keep whittling away at some of this, so forth. And then all of a sudden, more food got ordered. And then after a while, I figured out it was when you stop eating, there won't be any more food ordered. And that seems to be sort of what was going on here with Benjamin, but with more food being set in front of this growing boy, they did not get jealous, even though it reflected that Joseph clearly was playing favorites. Joseph is going to carry his testing further, and the brothers are going to be found once again ready for that which God put before them. We pointed out the people that got out of Saigon on the last day before it fell in April of 1975, you know, the first thing is, let's get on the helicopter. Then you have someone getting on there and they've got their stuff. That may have meant someone else didn't get on. That would be a place where I would say that was misplaced set of priorities to say, okay, I've got some money here. I've got a few other things. I want to have it. Life is more important than that. What Joseph did was not a sacrificing of a life. But what Joseph did was he blessed unevenly those who had seen their lives being spared. And they did not switch from saying, oh, why is Benjamin being blessed in this way? And start to turn against him in jealousy. There has clearly been a change in their hearts. Just like Esau, who wanted to kill Jacob, God had worked in him. Any questions? And then we'll pray. Father, we do thank you for your word. We thank you for your faithfulness that you demonstrate. We also thank you for the way that you have shown us the type of rewardable leadership that was exercised by Judah. Remind us about your promise to reward faithful servants. We know clearly that we received everlasting life as a gift, not as a reward. But once we have life, because we have believed in your Son for his gift of everlasting life, you give us the opportunity to become rewardable servants. Cause us to look to Judah and to other examples in the Bible of those that are faithful servants, rewardable servants. And may you say, well done, good and faithful servant. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.